Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, who are the most dangerous people in America? According to author John Nichols, the answer to that question includes the following: Betsy DeVos, Scott Pruitt, Stephen Miller, Steve Bannon, Jeff Sessions, Elaine Chao, Chris Kobach, and Rex Tillerson. The list goes on to include over 40 members of President Donald Trump's inner circle. Nichols thinks Seattleites may not understand how Trump works because we were too busy attending progressive talks and meetings way back when to watch Trump's TV show, The Apprentice. That's a compliment, but he argues that Trump used highly questionable apprentice-type auditions to decide who to hire for some of the most powerful positions in our government. He calls it, quote, the biggest grifter convention in modern times. John Nichols is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation and the author of Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. He spoke at a Town Hall Seattle event at the Summit on Pike on September 11th. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum. Thank you to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Here, Town Hall's Edward Wolcher introduces the event.
We are so excited to be hosting John Nichols, returning to Seattle, presented by Town Hall in this beautiful Summit event space. My name is Edward Wolcher. I am the curator of lectures at Town Hall Seattle. And on behalf of Town Hall and our partners at the Elliott Bay Book Company, who are set up at the back of the room over there, welcome, solidarity. This event with John is presented as part of Town Hall's Civic Series, a series supported by the Wincote Foundation, the True Brown Foundation, Real Networks Foundation, and KOW. And all of our literary programs this year are supported by the Amazon Literary Partnership. John Nichols is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation, one of my favorite magazines, and is a contributing writer for The Progressive, The New York Times, Chicago Tribune, and more. He's the author of many books, including The Genius of Impeachment, a book that has some resonance again right now, as well as the best-selling biography of former Vice President Dick Cheney entitled Dick, The Man Who Is President. John has a way with titles in his books. He edited the Against the Beast, a documentary history of American opposition to empire, a book which the late Howard Zinn praised for reminding us that the revulsion to war and empire has a long and noble tradition in this country. His 2011 book, The S Word, A Short History of an American Tradition, Socialism, I think we can now say without a doubt was ahead of its time, since socialism is on pretty much everyone's lips in the last couple of years. And he was last in Seattle to support one of his many books co-authored with Robert McChesney, the most recent of which was People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. But tonight he is here to talk about this compendium of horrors he has gathered for us tonight, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. Join us in giving a warm Town Hall welcome to John Nichols.
Oh my, look at this. I thought everybody would get lost on the way to Town Hall. They would think it's someplace else. But I guess that this new technology lets you find your way. Thank you so much for coming out. I believe that the spirit of West Coast resistance is alive and well in Seattle, Washington. People say to me, you know, oh, you're just preaching to the converted. Well, I've been looking at the polls. If we get any more converted, it's going to be all of us. We have a very dark moment in this country. It's a very complicated and ugly and difficult time, which is exactly what I like, because I like to go in and tear this stuff apart, get to the heart of it, and hopefully figure out how we can most effectively resist that which is by its nature, not by you know, some rhetorical reality, not by some, you know, theory, by its nature, destructive and evil. And we need to name it as such. So if you're uncomfortable with that, stick around anyway. We'll say something else you like. I do want you to, I want to recommend one of the events that was discussed. First off, I'm delighted to be with Town Hall. It's always a fabulous audience, always great crowd, great questions. And I'll go quickly so we can get to a lot of your questions. But also, I do want to recommend that event with Juan Gonzalez. Juan is a friend and comrade. He is the co-host of Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. And this book is a really important book, which actually has a significant section on Seattle, because it looks at how we are building an urban resistance, not merely to the politics of Donald Trump, but to the politics that gave us Donald Trump. And this is an important thing to understand. Donald Trump did not just, you know, crawl out of the primordial swamp. I don't think. However, the fact of the matter is there is a swamp, and it does spin up creatures. And these creatures have defined our politics for way too long. And so what Juan tries to do in his book, and I promise you I'm not working for him, you know, in any major way at this point, but what Juan tries to do in his book is really get to the heart of that matter and talk about how cities across this country, both in the Trump era and frankly in the broader sense, can build up a next era politics, and that next era politics will be rooted in the absolute faith that there is enough wealth in this country, there is enough decency in this country, so that everyone can have a fair share economically, and everyone can have fair treatment as human beings, a part of a broad family that need not be divided or torn apart. It's a great book. Come on out and read it. All right. So I know you folks are saying, Mr. Nichols, why do we need another book about these Trump folks? I mean, really, seriously. I mean, I realize that it's been on television a bit of late. And on Twitter, which I think Trump has kind of wrecked Twitter, hasn't he? Did you see this that, you remember the woman who was in the great battle with Cheney over, she was a CIA analyst and right, of course. Right? Yeah, she's trying to raise enough money to buy Twitter so she can knock Trump off it. I'm torn about that because as a freedom of speech person, I kind of don't want to, stomp on his free speech rights, but I do like the idea that there could maybe be a warning. So let me tell you a little bit about this book. I started writing this book in February of 2016. In February 2016, I wrote a cover story for The Nation titled President Trump, It Could Happen. And my argument was that if you actually got out of Washington and television studios, if you went out across America, what you would find is that a series of developments over the last 20 years had made a substantial portion of the electorate so embittered, so terrified about the future, that they were open to appeals that historically would have been unimaginable, at least in modern times. We would have thought, well, that couldn't happen. And what I heard when I went out and talked to union leaders, to elected officials in places like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, all the states that eventually became very relevant to the year, this Trump guy's doing way better than you expected. And one of the things that they said again and again was that he's figured the Republican Party out. Now, I'll admit, that's not hard. Yeah, you know, it'd take a lot of rocket scientists stuff. All that Donald Trump did was take a look at the Republican Party and say, oh, I get what's going on here. Small group of rich guys get together and hire consultants and messaging people and pollsters, and they figure out how to get a larger group of middle class to lower middle class, sometimes even working class people, to vote Republican, often based on issues of race and gender and abortion and LGBTQ rights and a host of other things, promising them that, you know, somehow you will make America great again, and then actually using the power that is extended to the Republican Party to lower taxes for the rich guys. And what Trump did was very, very simple. He just wedged himself between the base and the rich guys. And he said, hey, I'm a rich guy. I know I've traveled in their circles and they're lying to you. And all of the grassroots Republicans are like, yeah, that makes total sense. And so they nominated Trump for president of the United States. And that was not a hard thing to figure out at the time, although I'm going to unfortunately shed my visionary claim, because as the fall campaign started going, I talked myself out of the belief that Trump could be president. I was like, this is really hard to imagine that this guy could become president of the United States. It would require an incredible sort of like weaving of our political structures. You'd have to win the Electoral College by an incredibly narrow margin in a handful of Midwestern states and actually lose the popular vote by, I don't know, 3 million. And, you know, that seemed very hard until it happened. But one thing, the reason that I say this book started back in February of 2016 was that as I looked at Trump, there was one thing that was absolutely 100% clear to me. He knew nothing about governing. And I don't mean nothing like, you know, George Bush knew nothing about governing, George W. I mean he knew nothing. He had never been actively involved in anything akin to mainstream politics. And I'm often a big critic of mainstream politics, but there's one value that comes from it in that you actually, if you get elected, say, I don't know, president of the United States, you know people that you can put into positions of power. Or you at least have some sense of the play. Donald Trump lacked that. He had no idea. And it was very obvious in February of 2016. It was very obvious in November of 2016 that this guy didn't know how to govern. And as a result, the people he empowered, the people he gave authority to, would govern. And they would define the future of the United States. And this is not to diminish Trump. I'm not one of those people who says he's stupid. I'm not one of those people who says that we should not read his tweets anymore, anything like that. I think we should pay a lot of attention to Donald Trump. The man is a dangerous, scary figure who is trying to divide us. And if you don't pay attention to that and you let him speak only to his base or only to a portion of society, that's much more dangerous than Donald Trump would be in and of himself. So I think we should pay a lot of attention to the guy. However, I don't think we should assume that if Donald Trump has a bad day, if Donald Trump says something stupid, if Donald Trump tweets something absurd, and we're saying, well, mark that day against Trump, mark that day against this administration, that's a big mistake. Because if Donald Trump went to sleep from now until the end of his presidency, if he didn't tweet, if he didn't even watch Fox News, if he did nothing at all till the end of his presidency, this would be the most destructive administration in American history. And that is the point of my book. That is the point I want to make to people. I think the resistance is beautiful and good. There's some women in the back row there with their Rise Up and Resist t-shirts. And I love the fact that they're, you know, yes, we should be wearing it all, right? This is good stuff to resist this. But what I want to say is we have to expand that resistance. We cannot let it be narrow and Trump-focused. It cannot be Trump-obsessed, because if it is, then we might well end the Trump presidency following the impeachment. But we might well end the Trump presidency following an impeachment, a resignation, his defeat in an election, and look back and say, wow, his approval ratings are very, very low. He didn't really pass a lot of legislation. You know, you run down the list of things that the pundits on TV talk about, right? And then only when you step back from it in the way that Howard Zinn taught me to look at history, only when you step back in the way that Noam Chomsky, I think, taught us all to look at our politics, only when you step back would you see, oh my goodness, Trump was a quote-unquote failure who supercharged the military-industrial complex as it had never been supercharged before, who deconstructed our domestic programs, who undermined our access to healthcare, to housing, to transportation, and in a period when we should be restructuring our economy to be dramatically fairer, made it dramatically more unfair. If that's what happens, we lost. We lost badly. And we lost more badly than just having Donald Trump in the White House. I hope I'm not bumming you out. I realize. And so I want to explain just quickly a little bit about how Donald Trump chose the people that he put into power. And this is a big deal because we often think that there's a Svengali guiding Donald Trump. Many, a handful of you probably had it in your, you know, you're like strong people, solid people, people who bike uphill. So last night you were able to watch Steve Bannon on 60 Minutes. And where he revealed he is, in fact, everything that he has said that he is, right? And he was not dishonest about this. He wasn't unrealistic about this. He was very, very clear in who he is and what he is all about. And yet to think that Steve Bannon is the guide to this administration, that he is the only defining figure, misses the point of everything that's going on. Donald Trump knows very, very little about governing. Donald Trump knows very, very little about politics as we traditionally understand it. Now, that doesn't mean he wasn't smart enough to win the Republican Party over or even the presidency. But what it does mean is that he had to turn to a lot of people very quickly to begin to establish an administration. Bannon's influence has been and will continue to be, don't think for a second he's gone. Bannon's influence has been and will continue to be philosophical. Bannon is a super smart guy. He is always the smartest guy in the room. Now, weirdly enough, in the Trump administration, Donald Trump is often the most reasonable guy in the room. And so what you need to understand is that being smart, being reasonable, being the adult in the room is not necessarily a good thing. But it is important to understand that Bannon's influence on this administration is a theory of how the of what the Republican Party ought to become. And that is a nationalist party that weds both social conservatism and economic conservatism around a fantasy that you can make society better for a handful of people, right? And that that handful of people, just enough to vote Republican and elect them, will move this thing forward. It is a very ugly, very divisive politics, rooted, and Bannon's very honest about this, rooted in Andrew Jackson. And I don't know what you learned in school, but Andrew Jackson wasn't a good guy. I mean, he was a really nasty person. He was a slaveholder who forced Native Americans off their land. I mean, you can just run down the list of things that Andrew Jackson did as president of the United States. And what you realize is that it was all about dividing the American people. And it's interesting, he had one group of people that he was really good with, and that was, or you know, really got along with. Well, that was white guys. And in fact, at that point, you'll note that in much of the country, the only people that could vote were white guys. And so it worked pretty well there. You didn't have to do a lot of voter suppression because you just didn't allow most other people to vote. But now we're in a different game. And so the Bannon influence, philosophical, media, and I think very much in the area of voter suppression. And in the book, I write about Bannon quite a bit, but I also write about Kris Kobach, the guy who heads Trump's election oversight commission, this voting commission that's been established. And at the bottom of this whole thing, what you have to understand is these people know that a lot of what they stand for isn't all that popular. They are going to try to make it much harder to vote. And if we don't pay attention to Kris Kobach, then we are not doing serious due diligence on this administration. So that's a roundabout way of taking you down from one level to the next level and urging you to keep on going through it. And with that, I'm going to talk about Betsy DeVos. Woo! Oh my gosh! She's the Secretary of Education. I know, this is an unimaginable moment. I live in a country where Betsy DeVos is the Secretary of Education. And Scott Pruitt is in charge of the Environmental Protection Agency. And Jeff Sessions is in charge of a department that's named Justice. I mean, what you begin to understand is that every one of Trump's appointees has their first responsibility making the name of the department that they head a lie, right? Scott Pruitt, Environmental Protection. No, they're not protecting. They don't want to protect the environment. You know, Jeff Sessions at Justice. I mean, this guy has spent his entire career trying to avert justice, and he is continuing to do so. And again and again and again, you see people that are just in the wrong place. But I start the book out with Betsy DeVos. And there's a reason that I do that. Because Betsy DeVos, in many senses, is the only honest member of the Trump administration. And I'll explain why. She isn't really all that honest. She has, in fact, spent a long time trying to essentially knock the underpinnings out from underneath public education in America and come up with a way to shift the resources away from public education and toward private schools, experiments in all sorts of things that will only leave our children less well-educated. However, there were a couple of magic moments in her confirmation hearing, one of which is where Betsy DeVos, who had spent, you know, really most of her adult lifetime working in the area of education, and she was asked about some basic programs for people or children with disabilities and a host of other initiatives as regards education. Maggie Hassan, the senator from New Hampshire, asked about it, and she didn't know which programs were federal and which programs were state. I mean, literally, her ignorance was so scorching that it would have disqualified her not merely from being Secretary of Education of the United States, it would have disqualified her from serving on a rural school board. I mean, this was really bad stuff. She could have been beaten in a school board race because you say she literally does not know which programs she would be dealing with and which she didn't. So that's really bad. But the honest part came later, toward the end of the hearing, when Senator Bernie Sanders, and I, you know, in fairness, I think it's sort of unfair to have Sanders on any committee that's analyzing a billionaire, because by the nature, he's going to actually ask pointed and useful questions. And that sort of blows up the whole Washington thing. But the other Washington, not Seattle. And so Sanders is sitting there looking at her, and you could tell he had the question coming. You saw it coming. He like goes slow, and he goes, this is DeVos. Hey, I don't want to be tough on you or too mean or anything like that, but, you know, you're a major Republican campaign donor. In fact, you're one of the biggest Republican campaign donors ever. You know, it's like the Koch brothers sort of look up to you for advice and counsel on how to do this stuff. And he didn't actually say that. That's a little bit of my filling in the blanks. But he did say this. He said to her, I just want to ask you, do you think you would be sitting before this committee right now being considered to be Secretary of Education of the United States if you and your family, which by the way includes Eric Prince of Blackwater fame, if you and your family hadn't given more than $200 million in campaign donations to Republican candidates for office, including members of this committee? Well, that's a mean question. Yeah, I mean, that's a, you know, it's almost like this stuff mattered. And Betsy DeVos, to her immense credit, did not say, well, of course I should be in this position. I'm a former school board member. I've been on state boards of education. I've taught education at major universities. I've written great books and respected texts on education. She couldn't say any of those things because she hasn't done any of those things. She didn't even send her children to public schools. And so she answered by saying, I don't know, probably. She actually said, you know, it's possible, you know, it could happen. And I thought to myself, well, there's a little bit of honesty. Even she knows she should not be in a position of authority over education in this country. The tragedy is that when she could not even answer that question in a way that would qualify her or open the door to her credibly serving in the position, the Senate of the United States approved her to serve as Trump's Secretary of Education. And the fact of the matter is, this is how Trump got these people. And this is an important thing to understand. Don't just blame him. There's a United States Senate. There's a system of checks and balances. There's separation of powers. And Mitch McConnell looked at all of that, and he said, you know, I'm really tired of having obstructed Barack Obama for 8 years. Now I'm just going to give a president whatever he asks for. And the Senate collapsed as a functional check and balance on the presidency, as did the House of Representatives. I will go so far as to say we do not have a Congress at this point. It's tragic, and I don't say it casually, but if you think we have a Congress at this point, you're not paying attention. They literally are giving it away to Donald Trump, and they are doing so in ways that Democratic Congresses in the past did not give it away to Lyndon Johnson, that Republican Congresses in the past did not give it away to Ronald Reagan. Something fundamental has fallen apart in the body politic of our country, and that's another thing I write about in the book, because we need to understand that. This is a big shift that has occurred in our country. So that's one part, important part of how these people got their positions. Let me give you one other explanation of how these people got their positions. And I don't know, because I know that you're Seattle people and you're really smart and good and noble. You come out on Monday night to events in halls like this, and you know, you go to demonstrations and you elect socialists to your city council. And, you know, I mean, come on, you're just like amazing. So you may not have a lot of time to watch the show The Apprentice. But if you did, you would also know a great deal about how Donald Trump assembled his, you know, circle of grifters and you know, I mean, it's like, this is the biggest grifter convention that we've seen in modern times. But he came in not knowing who to put into positions of power and not trusting most of the people who traditionally would suggest nominees. So as a result, and this is not, you know, I wish I could tell you this is some secret I found out. It was actually on television. But do you notice, you know, we were all in such shock and busily preparing for the Women's March on January 21st, that we didn't actually watch kind of what happened in November and December. But Trump was at this, like, resort, in one of his many resorts, in New Jersey, and then also up at Trump Tower. And he had auditions. It was like The Apprentice. And they would have these people come in and make their case for why they should have control over agencies of the federal government that have bigger budgets than whole countries and that have more employees than whole states, right? I mean, these are really powerful jobs. The cabinet isn't, but is anybody here, by the way, just to interrupt as we'll get right back to this. Does anybody know how many cabinet members George Washington had?
Four.
Wow.
She answered four, and I was so impressed that she said, I just heard you on the radio talking about it, but cheating.
It's okay. Does a teacher mark you down just because you listened in class? I don't think so. So that's right. George Washington had four. We knew who they were. We make Broadway plays about them, right? I mean, it's very easy to kind of keep track of these guys. Now, we have 15, you know, major agencies, and then you have the ability to expand the cabinet by bringing in, you know, like some bunch of generals and other folks. And so, you know, you get up to around 20 or more people in the room at any given time. There's a lot of folks. It's way too many for Donald Trump to keep track of. In fact, at one point he was introducing Betsy DeVos, and he clearly forgot what job she had. And he was like, here's Betsy, and she's at education. And, I mean, it's kind of painful to watch the thing, but this is the reality. He didn't know. There's no way Donald Trump knew all the cabinet posts. There's no way that Donald Trump going in
had any sense of who he's going to put in these jobs. So literally, aides would say, Jared Kushner would walk in and say, oh, we need, you know, we're going to have to get ourselves a secretary, or he probably did say secretary of the EPA. It's actually administrator. But anyway, we've got to get somebody over at the EPA. And so they bring people in. They literally came up to meet, right? And there's simply no question. It's The Apprentice. You got the job if you yelled loudest, if you were the loudest yeller with the widest eyes, if you really had what Trump is always looking for, passion for the job, he gave it to you. And so our Secretary of Education, our Secretary or Administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency is, in fact, a guy who sued the Environmental Protection Agency 14 times and literally was the leading critic of the Environmental Protection Agency in the United States. Now, to Donald Trump, that's somebody who knows a lot about the EPA. But that's not, even a conservative Republican wouldn't choose that person to be in charge of it. It's madness. It isn't even a good deconstruction of the agency. It's such a ripping and tearing that it makes what it might still have been a functional agency, but more conservatively run, literally go into chaos. When I was working on the book, I talked to people who worked in all these agencies, and they told stories. One young man who's, by the way, don't ever hate the agency beneath the top level. There are all these people who've committed their lives to government and mainly came to agencies because of their passion for the environment, for justice, for whatever a different agency would do. And I met this guy, he said, you know what I do all the time now, every day after work? I go to a retirement party for the best people in the agency, the senior people. Hundreds, thousands of years of experience are walking out of these agencies on a daily basis because they're being run in such a chaotic and dysfunctional and often destructive way that people just give up on it. And they're not, and I don't fault them for it, because I've talked to some of them and they say, you know, look, I would stay if I thought I could do good, but I believe that if I stay, I will be part of the machine that is literally dialing this thing down, that is literally making it into something more destructive. And so we lose people like Sally Yates over at Justice, right? I mean, we're losing genuinely experienced people who should be heading these agencies. And Scott Pruitt is there because he was the loudest yeller. The fact of the matter is, at agency after agency after agency, in position after position after position, you have people who literally screamed louder than the other people that wanted the job, or who were more corrupted, or who were better grifters. And which brings us to Rex Tillerson. This is the big, if there's nothing else in the book that you read, and if there's nothing else that you take away from it, and I even acknowledge, you know, you don't have to read the Jeff Sessions chapter. It's horrifying. Although it does begin with, I think, the best line in the book. What can be said about Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III that has not already been said by Dr. David Duke? No, I spent a lot of time on right-wing and alt-right social media, and you got your sense of that. This is really ugly stuff. There is a lot of racism. There is a lot of xenophobia. There are a lot of things that are terrifying in this administration. But to my mind, the most terrifying thing, and the thing that ought to haunt us, and although, by the way, it's a fine holiday gift and it shouldn't scare you, but the thing that ought to haunt us is what's happening with the military-industrial complex in this administration. And this is an elaborate reality that you can only put together by looking at all the players and beginning to understand the role that they are playing. And Rex Tillerson's job is to destroy the Department of State. Now, I know he would not describe it as such, but the fact of the matter is that since he has come to the Department of State, Rex Tillerson has accepted massive budget cuts. He has not filled key positions. They have literally dialed down the diplomatic corps in ways that are unimaginable at this time in our history. And they're taking whole sections of the State Department, which, by the way, literally deals with issues that many people don't even imagine. Global technology, whether net neutrality exists between countries and how these things work. with environmental issues at the most fundamental levels, because, you know, the weird thing is that when the polar ice cap melts and the ocean rises, it doesn't just rise in America. It rises globally. And so the State Department is this really critical global and domestic entity, and Rex Tillerson is guiding it literally as if he was a CEO who was sent in to downsize a multinational corporation. He is bringing in these kind of reorganization groups, corporate ones, to look at it and figure out how they can do more with less. And the fact of the matter is, I don't want my State Department doing more with less. They're the people that are supposed to, and I know it doesn't always work that way, they're the people that are supposed to come up with alternatives to war. They're the people that are supposed to have us interacting with the rest of the world in a functional way. They're supposed to practice diplomacy, but also to show us how to use foreign aid, ideally in good ways. And one final thing, they actually have experts who know about other countries, like, I don't know, North Korea. And so as Tillerson downsizes this agency and seriously damages it, and by the way, it may not happen here, but when I've done events in D.C. and other places and I've talked about this, I have State Department people who are in the crowd who come up afterwards and they literally say, you were too soft on them. You don't know how bad it is. They talked about the same thing of the retirements, the massive number of people leaving. I've had outgoing ambassadors say, I volunteered to come to Washington to help my successor to make sure we had continuity, and I was told, we don't need you. This is what's going on at the Department of State is terrible, and it is part of the building out of a military-industrial complex. And this is a big deal. Everybody says that the generals that Donald Trump has put in positions of power, and I profile all the generals, read their books, looked at all their background. Then I say, well, they're the adults in the room. Well, with all due respect, just being an adult doesn't qualify you to be in charge of the strongest military in the world. And there are some adults who are actually wrong about things. And some of these adults in the room, like McMaster, who everybody said, oh, he's a very responsible guy, very decent guy. McMaster wrote a book about the Vietnam War, which was well received by our punditocracy, in which he said, you know, the military listened too much to the civilians. We were too concerned about domestic politics and domestic affairs. You know, you get in a war, you go in to win, right? And the fact is, I'm not sure that lack of nuance is exactly what we need around Donald Trump at this point. And Mattis, I will tell you, right, no question about it. There's absolutely no question in my mind that the reason that Donald Trump chose General Mattis to head the Pentagon was because his nickname is Mad Dog. I mean, Trump can't resist himself. Anytime he mentions the guy, he's always like, the Mad Dog. He's a Mad Dog. They call him Mad Dog. And Trump loves that, right? I mean, it clearly excites the heck out of him. Now, the truth is, General Mattis is a smart guy, capable guy, respected military leader. But he also has the name Mad Dog for a reason. And when you begin to explore his record, what you realize is that much of our media describes someone as an adult in the room if they are willing to use military power in situations where a lot of people might not. And so we have created a situation where we've dialed the State Department down and dialed the Pentagon up. And I'll circle around as we finish off here with my part, and then we'll talk to let you folks ask the really smart questions. Brings us to Mick Mulvaney. Does everybody know who Mick Mulvaney is? If you don't, that's okay. But I know a few hands go up. I know some people don't like to raise hand in class and stuff like that. But Mick Mulvaney is the director of the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB director. He's a budget guy. He comes up with Trump's budget. And the thing about it is, before he was that, he was generally thought of as pretty much the kookiest guy in the House of Representatives. Like the loudest yeller, once again. And you're sort of like, how did Mick Mulvaney, like it's from down in the Carolinas, who didn't even back Trump for president, end up in charge of making basic budget decisions, usually doing the balances where we make these things work? And then you realize, okay, oh, he was a grifter real estate developer. Literally, I write in the book about it. He like was selling swampland. They were developing swampland down in the Carolinas. And I'm sure when he went to meet with the president, they found some common ground. But the fact of the matter is, Mulvaney is a guy who was on the kind of extreme end of the Freedom Caucus in the House of Representatives. He loved the idea of shutting down the government. He despised government. That is not the best person to have in charge of the budget, right? I mean, even if you're a conservative, unless you really want crisis upon crisis, you don't put him there. And the fact of the matter is, if you look at the budget that Mick Mulvaney came up with, he proposes taking tens of billions of dollars out of domestic programs. And remember, the budget is the moral document of any administration. It also is the Rorschach test. It tells us really where this administration is. They propose to take tens of billions of dollars out of domestic programs and move it directly to the Pentagon. We're dialing down the Department of State, not filling key positions, literally abandoning diplomacy. We're filling our key military positions with generals who are some of the people who just have a record, whether you like them or not, whether you agree with them on everything or not, and you can even respect them as generals in some cases, but have a record of believing that the military should be supercharged and massively funded, more so than the most expensive military in the world should be more expensive and be bigger. And then you have a budget director saying, you know, we're going to steer everything we can, every opening we get, every compromise that we do will be aimed at dialing down domestic programs and moving money to the Pentagon. This is scary stuff. Mick Mulvaney actually criticized Meals on Wheels because he said, you know, Ray, it's got a good reputation, but, you know, do they really feed the old people that well? And, well, the answer is yes, they do. It's an incredibly efficient program that gets very, very little federal money, just like public broadcasting and all sorts of other things. But this guy wants to gut these things out so that there's more money for the Pentagon. There was a poster some years ago that showed a little girl. And she's looking up at the camera and she says, Mama, the president says I have to give my lunch money to the generals because they need more guns. That is the basic premise of what is happening within the Trump administration. Not wholly because Donald Trump even understands or frankly focuses on these issues, but because the people he has empowered are running this train. And every day, no matter what Trump is tweeting, no matter what Trump is, you know, what he's saying, if he cuts a deal for a minute with Chuck Schumer, the fact is these things continue on a daily basis. And the hero of my book is not some radical. Well, actually, the hero of my book is those who are resisting. I dedicate the book to my mother, who, if I could just give you my mother's story, she's 87 years old. She lives in Burlington, Wisconsin. And I was on like the second day of the tour, and one of my mom's friends texted me. And whenever one of my mom's friends texts me, you know, she's 87 years old, I'm like, oh my gosh, there may be something, you know, immediately, what's up, what's up? And the text was, your mother is at it again. And it was a picture from Racine, Wisconsin, outside the courthouse with my mother in her red cape, surrounded by members of Voces de la Frontera, our Hispanic and Latino rights group, immigrant rights group, as they protested against the DACA order. And so that's where I come from. But actually, weirdly enough, the hero of my book is Dwight Eisenhower, who's not a radical. But Dwight Eisenhower, I believe the function of Donald Trump's presidency and the function of the people that he has empowered is to cause us to recognize the vulnerabilities in our system. The Electoral College, created in slave times, designed to prevent the people's will from dominating, from guiding things, made Donald Trump president. He lost the popular vote by 3 million votes. In most countries in the world, he wouldn't be president. That is a vulnerability. Another vulnerability is cabinet style government as it has developed today, with limited oversight and massively powerful agencies that can literally make orders and do things without any check and balance on them, or with very limited checks and balances on them. So I wrote this book to get people to focus there and understand that we have to put a tremendous amount of our resistance energy into these areas. But Eisenhower becomes a hero because he warned us about these vulnerabilities, particularly as regards the military-industrial complex. Eisenhower gave two great speeches in his presidency. You all know about one of them, and that is the speech on the military-industrial complex, where he said, interestingly enough, that if you combine the military with corporate power that is enriched by the expansion of the military, and this is the final part of it, not often remembered, with science and technology, which thus has it brings in the ability to define where we go in the future, which takes the energy of defining our future away from domestic concerns, away from human concerns, and over to how do we kill better, right? He said this could destroy the country. This could define the country in ways that will be absolutely terrifying. And he warned us about it. It was good advice and counsel. But the more amazing speech he gave was only a few months into his presidency in 1953. It was called the Cross of Iron speech. And he said, as the most respected general in the world at that time, the guy who had literally beaten fascism, and in the midst of a Cold War, he said, I know there's a lot of people who say we got to build up the Pentagon budget and do all this stuff. I just want to tell you, every battleship that we build is a school that doesn't get built. Every weapon system that we spend money on is a housing project that doesn't get completed. Every military expansion, every new base around the world, every new big thing we do is a highway or a piece of infrastructure that we can't afford. The fact of the matter is that Dwight Eisenhower said, when you look at the balances of a federal government, you have to look below that overall budget figure and figure out where the money is going, who is being empowered, where the resources will be. He warned us that if we didn't do that, there was a possibility that in the future we would see an administration that would literally tip the balances against us. Not just to tip the balances toward war, but tip the balances toward a future in which the military-industrial complex and its extensions were dominant in every sense, and that our domestic concerns for civil rights and civil liberties, for economic justice, for social justice, would be dialed down and undermined, not merely by a right-wing administration, but by the structural realities of that administration. Eisenhower pleaded with us to pay attention. My argument today is that we have reached the point he warned us about. We're there. The balances are dramatically off. And if we merely oppose Donald Trump, but do not dig deeper into this thing and oppose the people he has empowered and oppose the imbalance that is beginning to dominate our country, we run the risk of ending up with a future that is so radically at odds with what any decent conservative American would want, a Republican like Dwight Eisenhower would want. We run tremendous risks. And so our resistance must be deeper, smarter, and more passionate. And it also must be confident. We must recognize this is not the America we want. It is why they act so frequently in secret. It is why they try to distract us so often and in so many ways. Don't be distracted. Take your resistance to the points of power. Say no, not merely to Donald Trump, but to Jeff Sessions and to Scott Pruitt and to Betsy DeVos and to the generals, and to Rex Tillerson, and to all of those who would lead us into a Trumpocalypse. The fact of the matter is we can avert it, but we can only avert it with knowledge. Solidarity.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. John Nichols is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation and the author of Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. He spoke at a Town Hall Seattle event at the Summit on Pike on September 11th. Thanks again to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. You can hear the full recording on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.